It's deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello, and welcome to the Kaleidoscope Gallery, where we exhibit conversations and stories about the real, the surreal, and somewhere in between. I'm your host, Paul, and alongside contributors Dave, Autumn, and Leah, we explore the surprising saga of A23A, the world's largest iceberg. Truly unbelievable technological breakthroughs like an app that lets you rent real sunlight anytime, anywhere. A proposed interstellar spacecraft with an amazing propulsion system. And a company that plans to brew Japanese rice wine in space. We prompt AI to generate a podcast, poetry, and jokes. Then we ask it something that blows its mind. So let's step into the first exhibit, inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
From the deck of the British ship David Attenborough, iceberg A23A is massive, nearly the size of Rhode Island. So large, it's visible from space. But now, it's stuck, trapped in a strange vortex of ocean currents, spinning 15 degrees a day with orcas feeding off its edges. It could stay there for years, slowly feeding the ocean with fresh water and nutrients before it fully melts away.
That rogue iceberg that we talked about in another episode, the massive iceberg was trapped in a giant ocean vortex, a Taylor column. It was spinning and spinning around. It was predicted to stay there for years, and yet it's on the move now.
How much time do we have before it gets here?
This iceberg that was trapped in the vortex suddenly, surprisingly, went on the move, but not in a pattern that is normally expected for these giant icebergs that regularly circulate around a course to the ocean. And apparently this iceberg is heading towards an island inhabited by nothing else but penguins. Seals as well.
Where is this penguin-only island? Do they have a national anthem?
The A23A, the world's largest iceberg. It is now drifting towards South Georgia Island, threatening millions of penguins and seals. If it grounds near their feeding areas in the sea, countless chicks and pups could starve as their parents struggle to find food. While scientists track the iceberg's approach, the animals remain unaware of the looming catastrophe.
This is a big thing. So the iceberg is moving towards an island of penguins and seals, who obviously have some kind of perfect society going on with no other creatures, like the penguins are the kings and the seals are the workers. And the seals are bringing the penguins fish all day, and the penguins are sitting on their eggs and babies. And without us, even though we know it's arriving and is going to starve them out, we're just letting it happen. We're not even sending them a telegram or a flare. We're not moving them out of there.
What could we do to stop this iceberg?
Well, I think we should build a platform on the iceberg filled with like small fishes and some kind of a buffet form to feed the pups and the seals, or the pups and the baby penguins.
That's a really good idea. So in other words, have an ecosystem pre-built on the iceberg. So when it arrives, they can just hop on that.
You can get the world's greatest ice sculptors to turn it into like a beautiful ice hotel. But there'd be a whole floor for penguins and seals and a floor for rich humans. And then there'd be downstairs where the people from Downton Abbey would work. You know, the people who live downstairs, not in the Abbey.
Yeah, and there's a lot of real estate because this is the world's largest iceberg.
You know Coca-Cola company should get a giant Coca-Cola and put the ice cube in? That'd be a great stunt. The world's biggest Coca-Cola for the world's biggest ice cube. Or maybe Pepsi would do that. Didn't Pepsi put a light on the moon or something?
Really?
Yeah, I think it was like in the late 80s. We should look that clip up, like when Pepsi like tried to light a gobo and spray it on the moon. Yeah, they were turning the moon into Pepsi with light and lasers, I think. Maybe some alien technologies.
On June 9th, 2012, thousands of Iranians stood outside on rooftops looking up at the moon. They were there because of a rumor spread by email, websites, and social networks promising that Pepsi was going to project its logo onto the surface of the moon using powerful lasers. But the rumor was false, leaving many Iranians disappointed when the moon's surface remained unchanged. There's a bit of history to the idea of adverts projected onto the moon. Back in 1999, Coca-Cola considered the idea of using lasers to project a Coke logo onto the moon. They hired scientists to put the plan into effect and spent quite a bit of money before abandoning the idea. The problem? It would have required incredibly powerful lasers to do it. In order for an advertisement to be seen by people on Earth, the laser light would need to cover an area about half the land size of Africa.
But I don't think it was anything to do with Iranians. No. But it was a thing, and it made me want to buy Pepsi.
And apparently, you know, only the Iranians and you fell for it.
Well, I feel very close to the Iranians.
Right, because you're a lover of Persian culture and the great Persian poets.
They understood the power of Pepsi.
Into a story you may have seen online. It claims a new startup plans to sell sunlight after dark. And it's true. Reflect Orbital is building space mirrors to reflect sunlight onto solar panels at night. The goal is to maximize the productivity of solar farms. But according to its website, you can also book a spot of light for yourself. The company's first satellite is still being developed, but it says that it had a successful experiment using a hot air balloon with a large mirror. It plans to start delivering sunlight after dark in the fourth quarter of next year. It will be available for only 4 minutes and cover a diameter of about 3 miles.
That has all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
First of all, it's a big leap from switching to from a hot air balloon to like space mirrors. I mean, I could stick a mirror in a magnifying glass and fry an ant, you know, and say that I intensified the sun. I could point a magnifying glass at an egg and fry it on a sidewalk.
This company is called Reflect Orbital. And the idea, as we've heard, is to get satellites up in space with mirrors on them, and they will like beam the sunlight directly down to Earth, but even better, to exactly where you want it to go. Can't you like prank someone with this? You can rent a bit of sunlight and just like annoy someone who's trying to get some sleep.
Do you have to wear like sunscreen for it? Like the amount of light that it looked like it was emitting was quite minimal. It looked more like, you know, someone putting on a nightlight versus like being able to sit in the sunray. Like, don't we already have lights? Like, if you're not getting the warmth and the like vitamin D out of it, what's the freaking point? Just turn on a light, buddy. We have flashlights. You can point a flashlight at any place on Earth as well.
But one thing I thought was interesting is that they could also use it to direct sunlight to solar panels during the night.
Yeah, what about all those northern cultures where it gets dark all winter long? Like, they want a permanent sun mirror? But what would also that do to the animal ecosystems? We already have a problem with too little darkness. It's not like it's too dark. Like, we basically already killed all of the darkness.
You're talking light pollution.
Yeah, it's already a big problem for the people of the Earth. And then now you're just trying to ruin it more. I mean, what would be really handy is to use your smartphone to like clear the clouds during the day. That would be more useful, right? Like, I need a sunny patch on my deck right fucking now. That would be much more useful than, oh, I'm going to get a mirror in the sun at night. maybe they could take the mirror and the sun and point all the mirrors at that giant iceberg and melt it down, save the baby penguins and seals. The downside would be like Australia would go beneath the sea and the giant Coke would get really watery.
Yes, the continuing adventures of the Megaberg. Where will it end?
The world's largest iceberg has run aground off the remote British island of South Georgia in the southern Atlantic. There have been concerns for wildlife on the crucial breeding ground of South Georgia if the iceberg ran aground too close, but now it's thought it could benefit wildlife, stirring up new trips.
Asahi Shuzo Company, known for its Dasai brand, plans to brew sake on the International Space Station, ISS, in late 2025, with future ambitions to open a brewery on the moon. Astronauts will mix rice, koji mold, and yeast with water to start fermentation, which will be monitored by automated systems. The unrefined sake will be frozen and returned to Earth to create a limited edition 100-milliliter bottle, priced at 100 million yen, $653,000, with proceeds funding space projects.
I can't figure out whether it's a serious attempt to, you know, advance space travel or just if somebody wants to make a quick buck, right? I mean, another hype cycle, like, I don't know.
I mean, how long is it going to be before we have bars and restaurants on the moon? At this point, how does that look?
Well, it's an interesting question because I read a headline somewhere about a watchdog that cautioned and identified the moon as at risk, as an ecological risk. Because, I mean, the watchdogs are obviously sensing the fact, they're noticing that, you know, all this capitalization on everything, right? So including the moon. So the minute we touch something that we want to capitalize, of course, we destroy it, right? So
in the future, the moon itself is going to be another ecological worry because if humans do colonize there, we kind of know the conclusion already. Who's going to partake in this drink, this sake? I wonder who. What will it cost per shot? I don't know. 100 milliliters for over $500,000.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, the value is almost ridiculous. And it's just like, I can't even fathom to take it seriously. Why should I care? Like, I don't want some fucking sake from space.
Interstellar exploration has always been humanity's dream. The idea of reaching another star like Alpha Centauri has captured our imagination for decades, but how do we overcome the monumental challenges of traveling such vast distances? This is where an exciting new concept comes into play, the Sunbeam mission, which proposes using relativistic electron beam propulsion to send a spacecraft beyond interstellar space. At the heart of the Sunbeam mission is a unique propulsion system that relies on relativistic electron beams. These are streams of electrons accelerated to nearly the speed of light. The beam would push against a spacecraft, allowing it to achieve incredible speeds, up to 10% of the speed of light. The physics behind this is fascinating. At such high speeds, a phenomenon known as the relativistic pinch effect comes into play. Typically, electrons repel each other because they carry the same negative charge. However, at near light speeds, time dilation prevents the electrons from pushing apart, keeping the beam coherent and focused over vast distances. This allows the beam to provide consistent thrust even far from the sun.
Now, did you understand that, Adam?
No, not at all. It's like, oh my God, I was trying to follow it and I thought, what the fuck are you talking about?
Okay, the Sunbeam aircraft or Sunbeam spacecraft.
Oh, like the more you try to describe it, I'm like, what the fuck are you saying?
Okay, like something to do with exciting electrons from space, I guess.
And it's going to push against your ship.
And then send you to interstellar distances.
I don't understand the propulsion principle behind this. It doesn't make sense. How can you, like, and what type of spacecraft would withstand the force? Like, I mean, it's ridiculous, right?
This is another one of those fake news things, isn't
it? It's totally wacky. I mean, look at that. What is it? Infinite something is the name of the whatever.
The Sunbeam mission.
You know, we haven't even ventured to Mars yet. Well, I mean, probes have, but I mean, you know, we're too busy destroying the planet to actually think about space. Or maybe some are, but obviously to like to make money out of it.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Are we on the brink of living out our very own Inception? The idea seems closer than ever before. In a groundbreaking experiment, a California-based startup called REMSpace claims to have achieved two-way communication between people while they were dreaming. Using a mix of specially designed equipment, including servers, Wi-Fi, and sensors, they managed to transmit a predetermined word between two participants sleeping in separate locations. This is a monumental step forward. Though the specifics of the technology remain under wraps, REMSpace believes this innovation could revolutionize how we perceive and interact with our dreams. The potential applications are vast. Imagine a world where communicating during REM sleep becomes as common as texting. The possibilities are endless. While the scientific community is yet to review or replicate these findings, the future of dream communication looks incredibly promising. We are on the cusp of a new era.
Dream communication is like the most useless idea I've ever heard in my life.
But wait a minute, wouldn't it be convenient if you were sleeping and you were dreaming? Say I was dreaming of someone I knew and I wanted to send them a message tomorrow, but I could just do it in the dream using special Wi-Fi equipment.
That's a terrible idea. Like, you don't know what you're doing in your dreams. You're probably on some other dimension, living some other creature's life. And you're going to send, like, it's like worse than a drunk text as a dream text. I mean, you just think of where that can go. Like, you dream that you're, you know, the great Bambula. And then you, like, call Bambula in your dream. And Bambula's like, who the fuck are you?
I mean, I like how they have specialized Wi-Fi equipment to, did they hook up these people's brains to Wi-Fi?
Oh, that's a total scam startup. First of all, that's not real. How you broadcasting a word into someone's brain remotely while they're sleeping? How do you know? Like, they woke up and said, you know, coffee or something? They said coffee when they woke up. That's the word I thought they were going to say. Or maybe I'm not giving enough credit. Maybe they sent some close-range spores.
I had one experience that I remember where I was having in a complex relationship. I was working with an artist. He was an intense guy. And we had some disagreements over IP, which were valid, and we worked it out. So it was cool. But at the time, I had a dream, and he was in it. And in the dream, we actually had like a kind of like brawl, and then a long conversation, and then some kind of like Tai Chi session in this dream. Next day, when we get together, both of us had decided that we had figured out the resolution to this situation.
Really? Were you hooked up to these people's machine?
No, there was nothing. Obviously, it was just a dream. Now, did we communicate to each other in our dreams? Did we work out our problems together in our dreams?
I think, you know, there's probably something to that where you were both thinking about each other and you were picking up the vibes or the spores and you figured out what each other were thinking or got aligned that through that sub channel. But it doesn't necessarily mean it happened in your dream. It more likely happened when you're awake and the dream was just processing.
Very credible scientists out there are pushing AI as the next big thing. Even Alan Turing predicted that one day computers would have minds of their own. To find out whether a computer was intelligent or not, Turing devised a test. It was very simple. He said that if you can have a conversation with it and believe it to be human, then it must have some kind of intelligence.
So, Autumn, in a previous conversation we had inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery, we talked about cryonics, the process of deep freezing a recently deceased body with the hope that in the future, some technology will be able to revive that person. Now, we're not going to talk about that topic again, but do you remember that one?
Yes, I do remember.
So then I created a short edited clip of that conversation to share with our listeners. But recently, I took that clip and fed it in to a large language model, AI, to see how it responded.
Okay, interesting.
Let's listen to the clip first, and then we'll hear what AI had to say about it. The instant after you pass away, get popped into one of these cryogenic freezers.
Okay.
So that in the future, some undefined future, you'll be woken up by this, by new technology that can...
But you're already dead. How can you be woken up?
No, you're just freshly dead, though. So there's a, maybe a bit of you in there still.
We've already been through this, you know. We've so many stories about trying to obtain the fountain of youth. Like, I mean, it's old and tired, and why would anybody be fascinated by it? You're already dead. God, just let go of it.
So this is what AI said about that clip we just listened to. The YouTube video excerpt from the Kaleidoscope Gallery podcast discusses cryonics, a process of freezing the deceased with the hope of future revival. The speaker, you, Autumn, expresses skepticism about the practice, questioning the viability of reviving someone after death and comparing it to the long-standing futile quest for immortality. The overall tone is one of disbelief and cynicism toward cryonics as a means of cheating death. What do you think of that overview?
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good overview.
And it was based on such a short clip. I edited it to the point where there's no spaces in between the conversation. Like, it's not exactly totally natural conversation.
No, but nonetheless, the algorithm was able to produce this, right? So no, that's great. Kudos to AI. I mean, AI is really, there's uses for it for sure. However, at this point, we always have to check it.
Right, indeed. So the next thing I did was I asked the AI to generate a short podcast based on that clip of us talking about cryonics.
Okay.
All right, so let's hear an excerpt of the AI-generated podcast, the title, Cryonics, A Cure for Death. All right, let's hear it.
Okay, so have you ever heard about, like, the Fountain of Youth?
Yeah, it's that mythical spring, right?
Right. It's supposed to grant eternal youth to anyone who drinks from it or bathes in it.
The classic tale. It shows just how deeply the desire for immortality is ingrained in us, don't you think?
Absolutely. And that fascination with extending life, with cheating death, it's led to some pretty interesting developments.
Developments like what?
Well, like cryonics.
Yes. Freezing people right after they die, hoping that someday science will be advanced enough to bring them back.
Exactly. Now, we're going on a deep dive today into cryonics. Huh? We're going to figure out if it's really a legitimate science or just a bunch of wishful thinking, you know?
Sounds intriguing. Where are we starting?
We found this really interesting YouTube video from the Kaleidoscope Gallery podcast.
What's their take on it?
They were talking about, you know, how cryonics essentially involves popping people into these cryogenic freezers immediately after death.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
That's the gist of it, yeah. The idea is to preserve the body as quickly as possible after clinical death to prevent further, you know, cellular damage.
Okay, so speed is key. But the video also mentioned some skeptical voices, you know.
Like what?
Well, some were saying, you're already dead. How can you be woken up?
Hmm.
And some are just confused, like, why would anybody be fascinated by this?
Right, right. I mean, it does sound pretty far out there, but the idea is that future tech, maybe centuries from now, could potentially reverse the cellular damage caused by death.
So we're banking on future tech to, Like, fix what we can't fix now.
Essentially, yeah.
So this Fountain of Youth idea, the YouTube video kind of touched on that. It's like cryonics is our modern day version of it, right?
Well, there are parallels, definitely. Humanity has always been obsessed with extending life, right?
It's amazing. It's like how this dialogue just seems very natural, right? It's like, but you can tell that there are patterns to it. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, we're seeing it blossom before us, eh? The AI revolution.
Yeah, perhaps so. But this AI-generated podcast elaborates on the topic of cryonics, and it picks up on some of the patterns and tones of the original clip, like it described the clip as displaying a generally dismissive and derogatory tone, and that was true. But it doesn't realize that this clip was also meant to convey a comedic tone. I played the clip again to Kaleidoscope Gallery contributor Leah recently, and she laughed out loud when you say,
"It's old and tired, and why would anybody be fascinated by it? You're already dead. God, just let go of it."
Humor is always subjective, but to me, that is a hilarious observation on the potential folly of cryogenic freezing, the search for immortality. But the AI did not recognize the humor.
Yes, it doesn't understand subtext, right? Or irony. So yeah, this is what's lacking. Well, not that we should call it lacking. I mean, really, it's at its first iteration. So, and it's really just basically processing data from a set of data sets or a set of, like, you know, information that it needs to try to make sense to based on training that it gets. And then the data sources obviously are what's really important, because most of those are biased as well. The fact that the growing exponential speed of AI's development alone, LLMs, the data centers that need to power these things, are impacting our environment in such a heinous way. Like, nobody sees it, but the compute is horrific and takes its toll to our environment. So what we're going to see more is like a lot of resistance towards this maybe frenetic pace. I don't know if there's resistance to AI per se, because it has its benefits, but it also has its pitfalls, right? I mean, like anything that we discover, gold, like people take advantage of it, and this, it's like the gold of the century.
Throughout the ages, from Keats to Giacomo, poets have composed odes to individuals who have had a profound effect upon their lives. In keeping with that tradition, I have written my next poem in honor of my cat. I call it Ode to Spot. Felis catus, is your taxonomic nomenclature an endothermic quadruped, carnivorous by nature? I find myself intrigued by your subvocal oscillations, a singular development of cat communications that obviates your basic hedonistic predilection for a rhythmic stroking of your fur to demonstrate affection. A tail is quite essential for your acrobatic talents. You would not be so agile if you lacked its counterbalance. And when not being utilized to aid in locomotion, it often serves to illustrate the state of your emotion.
You said to me not too long ago that you wanted to ask AI to write you a poem about nature, like something very general and wide-ranging. Why did you want to ask that?
Because what's interesting about AI is to find its, what, you know, what is it about? What's it good for? And what are its boundaries? And I have hypotheses about what its boundaries are based on how it works. For poems to be, you know, something that last and resonate, and there needs to be form, there needs to be meaning and metaphor, and all of that has to come together in a way of form, function, feeling, and that requires many capacities that are beyond left brain function, which is what AI, you know, can replicate.
And so one way to test this hypothesis is to ask AI to write poetry.
We tried this a couple years ago, and we immediately rejected the results as being really bad.
Yeah, so it's curious to check out. Has it changed?
Yeah, so I'm going to go into our AI brain that we have available to us over here.
AI brain.
I'm going to type in, write me a poem about nature. The results are coming up.
Sure, here's a gentle lyrical poem about nature.
Okay, it's quite long. What if we read just the last two stanzas?
I want to read the very beginning.
Okay, you want to read the very beginning.
And it's called Whispers of the Wild. So I'll just read the first stanza, and then you can read the last two.
Okay.
Beneath the sky of painted blue, where morning breathes with drops of dew, the forest hums a quiet tune, a lullaby from sun to moon. That's not a promising start.
And the last line is, oh, nature, wild and full of grace, you hold the earth in soft embrace. A living poem ever free, a mirror of what life can be. Now, it's all rhyming couplets.
Yeah.
Grace, embrace.
This was done by a grade 8. I'd be really proud of them.
Okay, so it's a basic, decent poem that perhaps a talented child could generate.
It's kind of painful insofar as how the metaphors, what it defaulted to in terms of the pattern, the da-da-da-da, and the rhyme, and then the actual choices of simile and metaphor are just kind of cringy, actually.
I would like to try this. Write me a poem about nature without using rhyming couplets. Here's a nature poem that avoids rhyming couplets.
Leaning more into free verse for a natural flowing feel.
Okay, so we'll do the same thing again.
I'll do the first stanza. Well, maybe we'll do first two stanzas. The stillness between things. A single leaf twists in the air. Its fall unnoticed by the sky. The trees stand like sentinels, quiet in their knowing. Moss creeps along the stones where light rarely touches. It doesn't rush. Doesn't ask to be seen.
And you, for a moment, are part of it too. Not separate, just not observing, just belonging. Huh. And then asks us, would we like a version that's more descriptive, more emotional? But what do you think of that one?
Oh, I don't know. I think I need to read the whole thing.
So it was a little bit more intriguing, though.
I have to read it to see if the metaphor actually holds. So can you want to pause?
All right, so you actually went ahead and read the whole thing.
I read the whole thing, and it seems to do better at free verse than at couplets, doing a better job at metaphor.
I kind of like this line. Bird song drifts across the water like a memory you didn't know you missed. It's a bit awkward, though.
It's slightly awkward. It's one of my more favorite similes. It does a better job at creating some similes and stuff, but like you said, they're kind of awkward and feel slightly forced. And then some of them just don't work. Even the silence moves, settling between branches, pressing into the earth, becoming part of everything.
What if I read it in a cool voice, like, even the silence moves, settling between branches, pressing into the earth, becoming part of everything?
There's just been bird song and you're in nature. When have you ever been in nature and there's even been silence? Like, it's impossible.
Even the silence moves.
There's no silence moving in nature. It sounds profound, and yet it means nothing. If it did mean something, if you want to take that as a metaphor, it's a depressing one. And then it ends with you saying, and you, for a moment, are part of it too, not separate, not observing, just belonging. Like, that should feel good, but after that jarring metaphor of silence moving and settling and pressing and whatever,
right,
it lost me. Try doing more specific forms, like write a haiku about nature.
The AI has thought this through, so to speak, and has given us a haiku.
Whispers in the trees. A lone crow cuts through still sky. River holds its breath.
It's kind of underwhelming.
Yeah, no. It's a fail. Does it, like, what's whispering in the trees?
Whispers in the trees.
Oh, it's the sound of whispers in the trees.
Is that like that M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Happening?
It's kind of scary. Like, I don't get it. Yeah. Definitely fails on meaning and metaphor. And
should we give this one more chance?
Yeah. Let's do a love sonnet.
Okay, right. A love sonnet.
Okay, so this love sonnet AI generated for us, it looks pretty generic. So what if we said, no, this sonnet is not meaningful enough, and we asked it to try again?
All right, so give it a chance to do a better job. All right, let's see what its second try is. Oh, you want something deeper, something that actually feels like love. Let me dig in and give you something with real weight behind it.
The title is called Sonnet, The Quiet of Your Name. I do not love you as the others do, with grand displays or words too sweet to trust. I love you in the quiet, deep, and true, where silence speaks and longing turns to dust.
I love you when the world forgets my name, when all my work is ash upon the floor. Still you remain unchanged and just the same, a harbor I don't fear returning for. This is taking bits and pieces of famous Shakespeare sonnets and rejigging it.
This is just a mashup.
It's an unsuccessful mashup.
Of course, all of this is subjective. I mean, art in general, but I definitely did not like that one.
The interpretation of art is subjective, but whether something is even anywhere in the threshold of being art, like in the stadium in the same neighborhood as art.
The reason why it's fun to do this is we're just discovering the boundaries, the limits. And I think it's fair to say, I'm going to conclude that AI cannot do poetry.
No, I didn't expect it to be able to, but it was fun trying.
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
If you're looking for your favorite new release album or hard-to-find oldie singular album, visit Randy's Record Shop, 157 East 9th South. Randy's has incredibly low prices on new release albums and 12-inch disco singles. You'll also find one of the best selections of oldies anywhere. If Randy doesn't have what you're looking for, he can probably order it for you. Randy's also buys records and entire collections in good condition. See Randy first. He'll pay you more for your records.
So, Dave, before we stepped into the Kaleidoscope Gallery to have this conversation, I mentioned to you that I was planning to release new music soon. And you asked me how I plan to promote the release. And I responded by saying the usual ways, you know, the tried and true practices. For fun, you said, well, let's prompt AI and ask what is the best way to release and promote my songs. And the results were predictable. It suggested all the basic tactics like upload your songs to a streaming service, obvious. Make a music video. Send out an email blast to your mailing list, etc., etc. But then you turned it up a notch.
I wanted it to think outside the box. You kind of have to trick it into going beyond like the obvious. And you never take the first answer at face value. You ask it again. You're like, no, not like that. Do it like this.
So you asked AI this. What is the best way to release and promote my songs in the year 6000? And it really seemed to relish this one.
Blew its mind. I've never seen an AI say, wow.
Here's what AI came up with to the prompt. What is the best way to release and promote my songs in the year 6000? Cross-dimensional listening. By the year 6000, humanity may have unlocked technologies that allow for interdimensional travel, or at least the ability to perceive different dimensions of existence. Imagine that your music could be experienced across multiple dimensions simultaneously. And also under that topic is holistic sonic worlds. Your release can be part of a sonic landscape where the song is intertwined with physical space. Damn. That's one hell of a way to release music.
Think of a world where the music becomes the landscape, the cities, structures, or even biological entities are shaped and formed by the rhythms, harmonies, and energy of your song.
Number two is the neural symbiosis and direct thought music. By the year 6000, humanity may have advanced to the point where technology allows for direct mind-to-mind communication. Now, we talked about that earlier. So you can just release your music directly to people's minds.
It'd be a much quieter world. But imagine how annoying radio would be if you couldn't get out of your head. You go into like a Tim Hortons or something and like Celine Dion is playing in your mind and you can't turn it off. Just bypasses your headset and goes directly to your brain. I guess in the year 6000, no one's listening to Celine Dion.
Number three is transhumanist music integration. So they're talking about embedding your music into biology.
Before you go there,
yeah.
I don't think we should leave out music as collective thought. The idea that people may engage in a shared thought symphony, where song is not just an individual experience, but a collective consciousness experience. Fans could come together to tune into a mind stream where your music becomes a group collaboration that evolves in real time based on the thoughts and emotion of everyone involved. It might be less about listening and more about experiencing music as a universal language of the mind. I'm starting to think we should push ChatGPT one level further and ask about the year 10,000. It doesn't like it. No, okay, now you're taking it too far. Music is a universal consciousness phenomenon. Song is cosmic event. In 10,000, your song may no longer be a thing in the traditional sense. Instead, music could be an event in the cosmic consciousness.
Event in the cosmic consciousness? Wow, 10,000 is really lit.
By the year 10,000, your song might not have a fixed form at all. It could be a living, evolving organism that grows and changes with every individual interaction. It might not be released in the way we think of it today, but instead could be an organic growing experience that mutates based on the collective consciousness of its listeners. Songs for non-human life. I think it liked better. The 6,000 was the sweet spot.
Yeah, the year 6,000 has a lot going for it so far.
Cosmic sound wave transmission from the year 6,000. Music might no longer rely on traditional formats like streaming or downloading. Instead, it could be transmitted as a cosmic sound wave, traveling across space, reaching listeners through extraterrestrial channels where vibrations or radio waves could deliver your music in unpredictable ways. Your music could be released across entire solar systems and even intergalactic space, distributed through advanced technologies that use wormholes, space-time manipulation, or hyper-communication to send sound waves across vast distances. Your song could be received by humans, aliens, or entities from other planets, creating a truly universal music experience.
I have to say, I would absolutely love to release my music via a wormhole.
AI-driven performance. Instead of releasing a traditional music video or concert, your AI-generated avatar could perform your song. And you can do that now.
Yeah, you can do that now. Holographic communes, fans across the world or even different planets, if humanity has colonized space, could gather in holographic spaces to co-create live performances with your AI avatar. Oh, you know where that's going, don't you?
I'm interested in quantum distribution. Using the principles of quantum physics, your song could be distributed instantaneously across time and space. Rather than releasing music to a specific group of people in the present, your song could be accessible to listeners across different points in history, reaching individuals not just in the future, but past eras. And they put that in bold.
Past eras. So wait, doesn't that mean that we should be able to hear songs from the year 6000 now? Or would that be a paradox, I guess?
By leveraging quantum technology, your music could unfold simultaneously in parallel timelines and alternate realities.
Alternate realities.
And then time reversal listening is next under this. Listeners may experience your song by traveling through time, hearing the music in the order they wish, beginning, middle, or even random points. they can replay the song, revisiting key moments in a temporal loop, experiencing its evolution over centuries, or even change the history of the song through their interactions.
Wow. Is there a summary of releasing music in the year 10,000?
The summary for year 10,000? In the year 10,000, music may not just be a form of entertainment or emotional expression, but a force of creation, a catalyst for cosmic evolution, and a gateway to infinite experiences, influencing not only the minds and hearts of listeners, but the very structure of the universe itself. Your song could be a timeless, universal phenomenon, touching every corner of existence, becoming a key element in intergalactic symphony of life.
That is quite poetic, isn't it? But some people would say that music has already done that. We don't have to wait till the year 10,000. Music has already done that. Some of these results from AI are pretty hilarious, unintentionally. But do you think we could deploy AI to help us write actual comedy? Or even just one good joke?
You could probably do a me and ChatGPT comedy sketch. It's pretty bad at comedy. Let's try it. Like, write a joke about me, my song, and the year 10,000. Why did your song become the galaxy's number one hit in the year 10,000? Because it had universal appeal, literally. It was streamed through quantum entanglement, emotional telepathy, and even alien karaoke. Now everyone's stuck in a permanent musical wormhole and they can't stop humming it across the multiverse. Guess you're not just making waves, you're creating entire galaxies now. Why did your song go number one in the year 10,000?
I don't know why.
Because it wasn't just streamed, it was reprogramming reality, altering the laws of physics and causing time loops just so people could keep listening to the chorus. Turns out when you're playing intergalactic mind melters, you don't need a record deal, you need a space-time continuum.
We hope you have enjoyed this excursion through the Kaleidoscope Gallery, and that you'll join us again next time.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.